Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Aldana Hayek, a cross-asset reporter with Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, the Federal Reserve surprised investors this week by simultaneously raising their projections for interest rates and lowering their projections for economic growth. The consensus seems to be that the nightmare for investors in both stocks and bonds this year is far from over, unfortunately. So with traditional strategies like the 60-40 portfolio allocation under continued pressure, what other options do investors really have? We'll talk to a quant at a major asset management firm who has some ideas about that. But first, Aldana, it's been a while. 2 weeks without you. We missed you terribly.
Did you?
You had quite an adventure.
I did. I went to Spain, as you know.
You did. And when you came back, I was delighted to see you actually did bring me some of that famous Spanish ham.
Don't tell Brian Duncan from the Illinois Farm Bureau, but I snuck some ham in for you.
You snuck some of that delicious Iberico ham in. But when you brought it to me, I was thinking, Aldana does not look herself. I thought either she's jet lagged or she's just so disgusted by having to bring this ham to me from
it was the latter.
All the way across. But it was actually
I had
a
COVID.
Third thing. You had COVID.
Yeah.
And luckily COVID, you cannot catch COVID from ham, I've determined.
Thank God.
Yes.
Thank God you were okay.
Even though your COVID germs were all over the ham, it was delicious.
That's what I get for
gallivanting
around Europe.
I was very worried about you, but now that I know you're okay, I feel like you can take a little ribbing. But how was the COVID adventure? You were pretty sick.
Yeah, I was kind of sick. I've never had it before, and it finally caught up with me, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's literally what I get for going to Europe
and
having fun.
So, well, we're so glad you're back.
How was the ham?
Feeling good. The ham was absolutely delicious. I know you're disgusted to carry around some swine for me. And I was very surprised. I did not actually expect you to actually bring that
I got
for
you
me.
The top quality version.
It
so
was
there
delicious.
Was like a $2 version and there was like a $7 version. I got you the $7 one.
In fact, I think you were probably not the only one sick over that ham because I was so hungry going home. I actually opened the package and started eating it on the subway. Yeah, and
right.
Everyone hates someone who eats on the subway.
Ham.
Especially a big pile of ham. But I appreciate it. It was delicious.
Good. Well, I do want to bring in our guest who I don't want to keep him waiting too long. It's George Patterson. He's the Chief Investment Officer at PGIM Quantitative Solutions. So George, thanks so much for joining us this week.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
And maybe I can start out with just a quick story, which is that I met you over the summer at a PGIM event, and we talked a little bit about you and about your background. And you have a very interesting background. You actually used to work for NASA, right? So I'm hoping you can just start out talking about yourself a bit and how you ended up with PGIM, considering that background.
Sure. Yeah. I'm one of the few quantitative investors that can actually say they were a real rocket scientist. I studied physics, both undergraduate and graduate school. And after graduating, my first opportunity was as a postdoc at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. So I was there for 2 years. Very great experience. Learned quite a bit. There are no more rockets at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. It was, at this point, but there was a lot of space related, science and physics going on. My project was maybe a little bit more tangentially related to space, but it was a great experience. However, after some soul searching, I became interested in quantitative investments and found an organization up in San Francisco, what was then Wells Fargo Nikko Investment Advisors, became Barclays Global Investors, and was there for quite a large portion of my career. I've been doing the same thing, quantitative investments, typically focused on serving large institutions. And I've been doing that since the mid-90s at a number of different organizations.
George, it's fascinating to me how many people with physics backgrounds, MIT types like yourself, end up in quant investing. Is it just the math background, or are there certain sort of principles of physics that are just easily applied to markets? Why is it that connection that we see so often?
Yeah, I think part of it is the math and the statistics, and not being. I think the great thing about the physics background is that they really teach you not to be afraid of going into a new field where you don't have anything, and really like taking it apart and understanding what drives it. So I've had several people who, or economists that have, said to me, I remember them saying to me at one point, we're so surprised, that you've done so well. And I said, well, that's because I don't listen to the economists who tell me something's impossible, because, I need to prove to myself that something can't be done. And, a lot of times you don't want to get in the way of someone who's trying to solve something that's not that everyone else says is impossible. So I think it's just that mentality you get that you need to. You need to challenge assumptions, you're always looking to disprove something. And the thing I like, and I've got a number of other physicists who work for me, the thing I really like about hiring, people with that background is many times in this industry, there's a particular project that I need someone to work on. And I may say, go off and, look at this problem or look at that problem. And a lot of times what you find is that, research is not easy. It's very challenging. You'll find that maybe whatever you set out to do is impossible. But when you hire someone with a bit of a science background, they'll always find something interesting. So they'll always come back to me and say, hey, we couldn't solve the problem, or we solved the problem, but there's no alpha in it. But we found several other interesting things that might be relevant. And sometimes that's an important part of the job. You just have to kind of follow your nose to see where the opportunities are. Research is not a linear process. You don't say, I'm going to go out and find a sharp ratio 3 investment idea. You have to, it may be out there, it may not. Part of it is discovering it. And it's, you have to be open to sometimes not necessarily going, where the specific agenda is leading you.
Yeah. And of course, now anytime someone wants to make a stock go up on social media, they use that rocket ship emoji. So some more synergy there for the rocket scientists.
And overlap.
It's like a lot of overlap. Yeah. But George, I know one area you're interested in and I'm sort of fascinated with is natural language processing. In other words, using computers to sort of read text and interpret it. And boy, we got a lot of words from Jerome Powell this week, a Fed statement and a press conference. I feel like his message was pretty easy to understand. We're going to hike rates. We're going to keep hiking rates aggressively until inflation is tamed. But I'm wondering from a quant perspective, from a natural language processing perspective, is there something more that a computer program can glean from a press conference like that and the statement? Or is it just a matter of being able to react quickly to it with trading algorithms? How does natural language processing fit into an event like that this week?
So there's several things that I would say are relevant. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that are running, you know, very short horizon strategies, looking at what words he chooses to use and like specifically like the questions and answers that come out of that and are looking to kind of, get in or out of the market very quickly to take advantage of kind of a short term movement. I think the real advantage, however, of language processing is just that you can go into depth. You know, you can read a 10K and analyze a lot of aspects of it. And you could do that for two or three of them, but it might take you, you know, it could easily take you half a day or a day each. The advantage of language processing is that you get the breadth. So you can do 3,000 of these, you know, in a matter of, you know, minutes or maybe half an hour, depending on what type of models you're running. But it's a combination of the breadth and the timeliness, I would say, that makes it relevant. And if you think about humans, like so much of our intelligence, so much of our knowledge is really encoded in writing. You know, we've been collecting numerical data for some time, but people have been generating written texts, you know, since the beginning of the beginning of kind of putting text down on paper. So there's just a huge amount of information that comes out and there's a lot of value in there is what we have found. So it's been one of the most relevant areas for us, you know, over the past few years to extract information.
Well, one of the words that kept coming up quite a bit during the Powell press conference was the word pain. And I read a bunch of notes after his press conference pointing this out specifically because of the market reaction that we saw on Wednesday afternoon. So maybe can you just lay out what in your view actually transpired with the Powell press conference and what we got from the FOMC and what you make of how the market reacted?
So my view is that, you know, over the summer with some earlier statements from Powell, he tried to portray a very, you know, serious view about taming inflation. And he came away saying that, you know, we're going to do it. But he was maybe just a little bit too dovish. And, you know, we saw a very large rally in markets over the summer as the result of that, even though a number of other Fed speakers came out and really were, were much more pessimistic about things. So I think really since then, what we've seen is he has just had to be extremely clear that they are going to get their job done. And, you know, it is going to cause some disruption. I think some of his earlier statements, he was trying to be a bit more balanced. But I think now, given the market's reaction, he has just realized that he has to be extremely clear about where he thinks things are going. And don't forget, it is a challenging economic outlook, but it follows several years of huge gains in the market. So, you know, if you look over a longer period of time, you know, we've had a lot of gains in a short period of time. So it's not unrealistic to expect a little bit of give back in the next, you know, the next year or two.
Yeah, George, as I said in the intro, brutal year for both stocks and bonds. That sort of traditional 60-40 portfolio has hit hard times, to say the least. I imagine for a guy in your position, there's a lot of clients out there saying, get me a rocket scientist on the phone. We got to figure out something else that works. So from a quant perspective, I know there's some stuff that's working spectacularly this year. I did a story on trend following and managed futures, commodity trading advisors who are really doing really well this year. Just by following the chart down when stocks are going down, when yields are going up, just following the trends. But what else is a solution from a quant perspective for a challenging environment like this? What are you telling those clients looking for something to either, you know, get some kind of return this year or at least protect the wealth they have?
Yeah, so, you know, there are several different things. I mean, first of all, we do have several offerings that focus on trend following or kind of global macro strategies or tail hedging. And you're right, those have been very successful. This is kind of the perfect economic environment where you do have big movements as well as some big inconsistencies across the globe. For example, looking at Japan and how, you know, everyone else is raising rates and Japan is really not. And, you know, we hear a little bit now about trying to have to defend the yen. However, there's a couple of other things. One is commodities and the other would be real assets in general. Maybe the last one I would talk about would be some downside protection. So commodities and real assets are, you know, we've seen kind of a big run up in commodities and a bit of a retracement. But over the long run, you know, there's a lot of research that shows that commodities do very well in this type of environment. Our view is that the Fed is going to be successful in taming inflation, but it's also going to take a little bit of time. It's not going to come down very rapidly. And, you know, we think there's a lot of opportunities for commodities in a portfolio. So that's one area. Commodities, I think, also have real assets, whether it's real estate or other, you know, direct real investments that are also typically do very well in inflationary times. I think the other thing that we see a lot of conversations about is downside protection. How do you build a strategy that can either hedge tail risk or just, you know, deliver most of the upside while limiting the downside? And there, again, there's a number of different solutions we offer in that area. So those, I'd say, are the main subjects that we've been talking about to clients that we've seen the most interest in.
George, can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I know you sent us some notes before the podcast that you said it's important for investors to consider defensive strategies. So what specifically? Maybe you can just go a little bit more into detail.
Yeah. So you know, a lot of times, if you look at a long-term investor, a long-term success, and what you'll find is that it's important to participate in the upside, but it's probably more important to avoid a large drawdown. So, you know, the drawdowns are very difficult because if you have like a 10% drawdown, you need more than 10% to recoup the return. Just mathematically, a 10% drawdown followed by 10% gain doesn't get you back to where you started. So if you have some ability to either avoid or limit those drawdowns over long periods of time, that can be very beneficial to an investor. And if you think about it, there, you know, it's valuable to an institution, but for a person, it's even more important, you know, particularly if you get into the, you know, kind of like 5 to 10 years before and after retirement, you have to be very careful because that's kind of the period of time when if you have a drawdown, it could be very detrimental to like retirement savings. So there's a number of different, ways that you can get into, develop drawdown strategies that do well. I mean, in some occasions, people look at low vol strategies. We have a different approach that kind of combines, both market and fixed income exposure with some optionality to basically give you downside protection, but at the same time, participate in most of the upside. So it's something that, from our perspective, should have a place in many portfolios.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, you mentioned real assets, so I wouldn't mind unpacking that a little bit. I mean, I think there's this huge curiosity and demand for sort of alternatives, liquid alternatives, you know, stuff outside of the traditional stocks and bond markets and wherever that takes you. But obviously, liquidity can be an issue with alternative assets. So what looks good to you from that perspective? And is it tough for a quant to sort of apply your methods to non-traditional markets like that?
I don't think it's tough to, you know, they're different structures, but no, I think in many ways, you know, being having a quantitative approach allows us to put some sort of consistency across the different types of asset classes. And when we think about things, we think not about just risk and return, but we also think about drawdown. We think about, you know, kind of skewness. We think about liquidity. So, I mean, from my perspective, from a quantitative approach, it, you know, definitely complements, more traditional approaches. So illiquid assets, you know, private assets has been extremely hot, you know, I'd say the last few decades. We've seen a huge amount of money go into them. And, you know, those assets have done quite well. You know, private assets definitely have a place in a institutional investor's portfolio. The challenge really, as you mentioned, is liquidity, because some of these investments, you know, not only require you to make an initial investment, but there's also ongoing capital calls. So, you know, what we have seen some clients experience is that, you know, if you have a combination of liquid and illiquid investments and the illiquids are requiring capital, you know, if you have that, you know, if you have that money invested in like equities, you might be forced to sell equities at the worst possible time because you need to make a capital call. So there, the question is not so much about looking at what's the maximum return I can get, but how does this fit into my portfolio and what is this going to cause me to do in a period of extreme stress? I mean, that's really the case. I mean, illiquids are great. It's just you need to kind of go in, as I say, eyes wide open in terms of looking at the opportunity and understanding how it's going to fit into your objectives.
So we all know, Tina, there is no alternative, and we've all been talking about it for such a long time. But the thing that I'm hearing now is Tia, which is there is an alternative to stocks. I don't know if you've also been thinking about this or hearing about this, but I'm wondering what you make of this idea that there are alternatives now. And, you know, somebody I spoke with earlier this week said you could hold your nose, for instance, and go into high yield. So what do you make of some of these alternatives now?
I think it's unfortunate that people are always comparing everything to the S&P, right? So the goal is to build a portfolio that gives you alternatives and outperforms the S&P. And I think that's a little bit of a high bar. I think the goal of alternatives is more to provide diversification and stability and is less about, can I specifically outperform the S&P or can I specifically outperform a specific target? I mean, obviously you want your alternatives not to be, you know, to provide the diversification, you want them to be reasonably priced, and obviously you want solid performance. But sometimes people, I think, are a little myopic, just saying, okay, I want an alternative, but it has to do better than this investment or that investment. So, you know, I think of alternatives much more in terms of risk control, and really, it's about figuring out what your investment goal is and designing a program that's going to get you there, as opposed to, you know, what's the highest possible return I'm going to get over the next month or 6 months. I mean, the world today is amazing in terms of what you can get. I mean, you know, when I was growing up, it was, you know, stocks and bonds. Now, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, real estate, you know, publicly traded, privately traded, you know, fractional assets, you know, where you can buy fractions of real estate or fractions of a painting. And I mean, we've just like the access to these things has become, you know, a little scary in all honesty, and that like you could really get into many different things that look, you, some of this I think is probably good, but some of it is maybe stretching a little too far.
Yeah. Vildana got me a fraction of a Spanish hog. That was that's the best asset I've had. That's a good gift.
That
was
for
a good
you.
Yeah, alternative asset. But George, you mentioned something earlier on that I want to sort of rewind and get back to, and that is that you said you do think the Fed's going to be successful in taming inflation, but it's going to take a while. And I don't want to put you on the spot. I know no one wants to predict that inflation's going to peak at this percent on this date. But I wonder how you're thinking about how that taming of inflation is going to play out. Are we bound to sort of retest the market lows from June and maybe even set new lows in equities? Are bonds going to continue to suffer? You know, what's sort of the near future look like to you as far as what the Fed is doing to fight inflation?
These are unique times, and I don't have I try to not make specific short-term predictions because, yeah, you know, my view is the way to be successful is to have a long-term perspective and to be focusing on the fundamentals that are driving the market. I would say, you know, when we look at inflation, we look at the components of inflation, you know, there are some components like housing that have been driving the recent numbers up. And we know that's a slow moving component, right? So even if they jacked up rates Volcker style, you know, overnight, it's going to take time for that to flow through. The other thing is that, a lot of research shows that these increases really take time to impact the market. So, you know, we're still raising right now while the first increase is really filtering its way through. Some things might happen very quickly in the financial markets, but in terms of like how these impact the consumer, it takes a long time. So, you know, that's part of the reason I think it's going to, I mean, I personally think inflation may have peaked. So, however, I don't think it's going to, we're not going to go back down to 2% overnight. I think it's going to be a multi-year trend. I think it is going to be, as long as you are raising rates, you know, and tightening financial conditions, it is going to be challenging for equity markets and likely fixed income markets.
Right. George, you said something there, too, that I find fascinating. You say it's such a unique environment. And I wonder, as a quant, you know, you're so used to dealing with historical data sets. And when you think of this environment we're on, like the closest comparison, obviously, like you said, is the 80s, that really high inflation and the Paul Volcker Fed really trying to fight it with both fists. But when you go back, you know, when you're running regressions and stuff and looking at your available data, when you get to the 90s even and the 80s, you know, you're so limited in the amount of data you're able to sift through. Does that make it harder for a quant, or is it, you know, just a matter of like, you know, for example, with trend following, well, you don't really care what the fundamental data was so much back then. If the trend's doing this, we're going to follow it. But, you know, what's it like for a quant dealing with unprecedented times, or at least times that are unprecedented as far as the robust sets of data go?
So one of the most rewarding parts of my job is getting to mentor young people in the field, young portfolio managers and researchers on the quant side. And the thing I always tell them is, you know, remember, you are an investor first and a quant second. So, you know, you cannot blindly follow the data. You cannot, just because of the historical relationship, you can't say we're going to use that. You have to think and understand what drove that and is there relevance. You know, one of the interesting things is when you're in the world of academia, you want to build a model to predict something new. You know, you design a model and say, well, can I make a prediction about some part of the world that no one's ever seen and test whether the model's right or not? From an investment perspective, I don't want my model to be encountering new scenarios that have never been tested. I want to make sure I've got some relevant data. And you're right. It is very challenging the further back we go to be able to use data and say, hey, I've covered every possible scenario. And that's really where you have to rely on traditional fundamental investment insights, and you have to pair those two. Now, that's a lot less relevant if you're running a high frequency strategy that holds stocks like, you know, for a fraction of a day or a nanosecond. You know, you could be purely model driven. But if you're thinking longer term, you really need to make sure that your model is calibrated, but also has been exposed to the different types of regimes that you might be in.
And I don't know if you and your team put together projections in terms of what to expect from the Fed, for instance, for the remainder of this year. Does it look like we're going to get another 75 basis point hike in November and a 50 basis point hike in December? Or what are you expecting?
So we do monitor kind of how futures are pricing the scenario, the different projected rate hikes. You know, personally, I think, you know, there's an element of this which is mathematical, which is what is the rate that they need to obtain. I think there's also a psychological aspect to let people know that they're very serious. So we do think that they're going to continue the pace of hikes really until they see inflation start to materially roll over. It looks like some areas have begun to slow, but the risk for them is that they become viewed it as less credible. And I think that they're going to do what they need to do. So, I mean, while this isn't particularly a house view, my personal view is I wouldn't be surprised to see another material rate just to kind of cement in the fact that they're so serious about taming inflation, which, look, I think is good for everyone in the long term.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com. The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
George, one thing, and I'm wondering if you've thought about this or studied it at all, but one of the big themes this year and really recent years has been the options market in equities seems to be sort of the tail that's wagging the dog sometimes. You know, you have options expirations in the middle of the month, and all of a sudden there's volatility either to the upside or the downside that seems to be completely related to, you know, options, gamma hedging and that sort of thing. Have you looked into that at all? And is, you know, not to sound like Jerry Seinfeld, but what's the deal with that?
it's amazing. And it really seemed to kind of pick up after, you know, after the lockdown, that all of a sudden there's just a huge amount of interest in options and meme stocks. And yeah, we have seen that there are situations where, you know, the tail is wagging the dog in some names, and that option activity has just exploded. You know, personally, I use the best indicator I use is what my, teenage kids' friends are asking me. And, a few years ago it was crypto, and then now they're all interested in options. You know, they don't want to trade stocks, they don't want to trade bonds, they're going right to options, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, there's limited downside. I lose the premium, but there's no question that, like, all of a sudden, you know, the retail interest has just, you know, skyrocketed in options. I think it's coming down a little bit now, but yeah. It's just, you know, there's this, you know, it's the greater fool theory, right? I'm buying something because I expect to sell it in a few days at a higher price, but there's no particular, you know, I'm just doing that because markets are going up. And you know,
yeah.
You know, that's great as long as it works. But as soon as it stops working, all the people that have been drawn into that change their view.
Yeah. Is it sort of a dead end street to try to find patterns there and trade off of them? You know, did the fundamentals sort of win out in the long run?
Fundamentals win out in the long run, but there's no question that there's hurting, right? There's no question that when, you know, some of these trends become established in certain names, it's not going to play out overnight. It can go on from like weeks to months. Our view is that we tend to focus on longer term trends, and we try to stay away. We don't want to be like you know, we don't want to be the, you know, the snail in front of the steamroller. So like if we see, you know, a huge wave of retail interest coming, a lot of times we just want to, we want to be patient and avoid that and let that play out a little bit, because then we think there's a better opportunity for the types of information that we process, which tend to be a little bit more longer horizon in terms of our holdings.
And George, we talked about Tina and Tia, but I'm wondering what you would recommend to somebody who would like to be sitting in cash right now.
You know, in all honesty, cash is not a bad place right now. You know, obviously, it's costing you something in terms of inflation. You know, there are some U.S. I bonds that give you some reasonable inflation protection, but there's a lot of there's limits on how much you can buy of those. Cash is not a bad place to be in the short term. I mean, inflation hurts you over long periods of time. It's less relevant over short periods of time, but look, I've got a decent allocation of cash because, you know, it's part of providing downside protection.
Well, George, fascinating stuff there. It's great to get your perspective. We won't let you leave, though, until we get to our little gimmick tradition here on the show, which is the craziest things we've seen in markets this week. Vildana, you know, you started off on this podcast before you were co-host. Remember, your title was Chief Crazy Things Correspondent.
Yeah, I was really good at spotting a lot of crazy stuff.
I think we're going to have to replace you with this guy, Twiggy Sunday from Twitter. I assume
Twiggy's
that's his
good.
Assume that's his real name.
Real name, definitely.
Yeah, that definitely his real name. He's hit me with a bunch of crazy things this week. So I'm relying solely on him for mine. But let's start with you, Vildana. What's the craziest thing you've seen in markets?
This one probably a lot of people already know about. So if you spend any time on Twitter, you probably saw this story. But the Beyond Meat, the CEO. Their chief operating officer.
Beyond Meat.
Do you know this story?
Wait, that wasn't like Beyond Meat ham, Iberico ham that you brought me, was it? You didn't trick me in.
No, it wasn't. No, it was real. You got real ham.
All right, good.
But Beyond Meat suspended its chief operating officer after he bit a man's nose.
What?
You didn't hear of this?
I did, but I thought I dreamed it. That really happened?
No, this really happened. It's just so ironic. It's a non-meat company. He bit somebody's nose.
Bit someone in the nose.
Yep, he's been suspended. And it's just, I mean, I love thinking about like these meat alternatives, as you know, but shares of Beyond Meat, I checked before the podcast, are down 77% this year.
Wow.
And I think partly it's because those alternatives are much more expensive. Like buying four fake meat patties is much more expensive than buying four hamburger patties. So,
and having a guy going around biting people in the nose, one would assume, I'm no quant, George, but I would assume that's not good for a stock price in general. That's pretty good. Well, how's the nose? How's the victim's
apparently,
nose?
So this was in the stories. Apparently he literally actually bit off a piece of the nose.
Come on.
Yes.
Or
there was at least some damage.
Oh my gosh. That is truly a crazy thing. How about you, George? You see anything crazy in markets recently?
You know, there have been all of these, you know, depreciating assets like cars and boats in particular. There's a period of time that, you know, there was such a short demand, short supply that, you know, you could take an old clunker that, you know, was probably worth nothing and sell it more than you paid for it, even adjusting for inflation. So, you know, we had a few old cars sitting around and, you know, during this time, I sold one or two of them in a matter of days. Pretty amazing. It's probably not the situation now, but I've heard it's the same thing with boats, you know, that there's such short supply of boats and demand has held up very well that people have been able to sell boats, which, you know, the ultimate appreciating asset for a profit.
I know. I was going to say, what's the old joke that the happiest days of a boater's life is the day they buy the boat, the day they sell it? Well, here's Twiggy's tweets to me, which offer us a great opportunity to play our little game show, the Price is Precise here. Okay, Vildana, the most followed influencer on TikTok is a guy named KB Lame.
Never heard of him.
Me neither. My kids make fun of me because I watch the reels on Instagram and they say those are all just TikToks that are like three weeks old. So that's where I'm at on the TikTok.
The youth.
Yeah. I'll probably get to this guy in a few weeks. He'll be 149, almost 150 million TikTok followers for this guy. So he gets some sponsored posts to put something on TikTok. So try to think what the highest payment he's gotten for a single post, okay?
Okay.
So that's on one side. On the other side, Twiggy sent me the golf bag. And that story, by the way, was courtesy of Fortune Magazine. They have an interesting profile on this guy from TikTok. The other one's from Golf Digest. It was the bag that Tiger used, his golf bag, in the 2005 season, which was a good season for him. I think he won the British Open, and he won the Masters. He was age 29. So the question is, and George, I hate to inform you, but you're now a contestant on The Price is Precise as well. I'm going to ask you both, which do you think is more valuable, one post from this guy on TikTok or Tiger Woods' 2005 golf bag? And give me a number that you associate with the higher one.
Well, I think the Kardashians make something like $200,000 or $250,000 per post sometimes, I think. So I'm going to go with $150,000 for the guy. $150,000? And that the bag is worth more.
Now, remember, this is the most he's ever been paid for a post. So that top tick of this guy's influencer career. You're going to go with one.
Oh, so not like his
not
minimum.
Not average, yeah. We don't know his mean.
Okay. I think that you're telling me that it's more than that.
I know, okay. I should.
So I'll go with 300, 350.
300, but you think the bag is worth?
350. Oh, then that makes the bag worth less, I think.
You think the bag's worth less than that? George, what do you think? What's more valuable, one post from this guy or Tiger's 2005 golf bag?
You know, there's a lot of people that are obsessed with golf, and you get the there's only one bag from Tiger, right?
Yep.
From that year. So I'm going with that as the more expensive item.
I would have gone with the golf bag as well. Especially, you never know, maybe there's some free tees and balls in there somewhere, little tiny pencils, but this guy, top payment for this guy's TikTok was $750,000.
For one post?
For one single post. So more than the Kardashians.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't get it.
That's like a mansion.
Tiger's bag, $391,000, which seems low to me, George. I don't know. I would have thought real assets, right? I would have thought the real asset would have won. But George, such a treat to catch up with you and hear your insights. We really appreciate it. And we hope someday you'll come back and do it again. Look for George on TikTok.
Yeah.
And we're on YouTube now, by the way. The podcast is now on YouTube. So look for us there if you can't find us in all the other places. I've lost track of everywhere.
There's
it is.
A lot of them.
There's a lot of places. Yeah. Yeah. But if YouTube's your thing, maybe some people prefer YouTube. I don't know. All righty. Thanks, George.
Thank you, George.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Vildana Heyrich is at Vildana Heyrich. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Stacey Wong. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.